Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Last night's US presidential debate was actually the second between the candidates for November's election. That the lineup was different this time underlines the potential risk and reward for the candidates. It was the Republican Donald Trump's televised thrashing of Joe Biden which crystallised the unease many members of the Democratic Party and voters already felt at the prospect of the octogenarian president running for re-election. So last night it was his successor Kamala Harris debating Mr. Trump. It was less dramatic and likely will have a less dramatic immediate outcome, but it still delivered moments of clarity about the two candidates, even if there weren't many direct answers to direct questions. Our Washington correspondent Tom Bateman was watching.
Face to face, historic. The ABC News presidential debate.
In a city that was at the heart of the American Revolution, a debate described by its hosts as this election's most consequential moment.
Good evening, I'm David Muir, and thank you for joining us for tonight.
And as it began, it wasn't just the first debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, but the first time they'd met.
Kamala Harris, let's have a good debate.
Nice to see you, have fun.
Thank you.
Kicking off on the economy, a key area of vulnerability for the vice president.
I've never seen a worse period of time. People can't go out and buy cereal or bacon or eggs or anything else. The people of our country are absolutely dying with what they've done. They've destroyed the economy.
Vice President Harris, I do want to ask for your response. And you heard what the president said there, because the Biden administration did keep a number of the Trump tariffs in place. So how do you respond?
Well, let's be clear that the Trump administration resulted in a trade deficit, one of the highest we've ever seen in the history of America. He invited trade wars.
Throughout, Mr. Trump kept trying to steer things back to his favorite issue, immigration, accusing the Biden-Harris White House of losing control. He then raised a false story originating from social media about Haitian immigrants in Ohio that had already been debunked.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country, and it's a shame.
I just want to clarify here. You bring up Springfield, Ohio, and ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there had been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community.
Well, I've seen people on television.
Several times, the moderators challenged Donald Trump for making misleading claims. He appeared irritated, at times getting angry, which led to Kamala Harris's chosen tactic of trying to bait him further. They sparred on abortion rights, an area the Democrats see as a vote winner for them.
And now in over 20 states, there are Trump abortion bans, which make it criminal for a doctor or nurse to provide health care. In one state, it provides prison for life.
They have abortion in the ninth month. They even have, and you can look at the governor of West Virginia, the previous governor of West Virginia, not the current governor, is doing an excellent job, but the governor before, he said the baby will be born and we will decide what to do with the baby. In other words, we'll execute the baby.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born. Madam Vice President, I want to get your response to President Trump.
Well, as I said, you're going to hear a bunch of lies.
The strategies of each became clear. He sought to portray her as dangerously liberal, with a failed record under Joe Biden, which was destroying the country. She attempted to marginalise him as unserious but dangerously bent on power for his own self-interest.
These dictators and autocrats are rooting for you to be president again because they're so clear they can manipulate you with flattery and favours.
On the war in Gaza, Kamala Harris was challenged over the vast numbers of Palestinians killed and on the failure to release the remaining hostages. She repeated her commitments to both Israel's security and ultimately a two-state solution with the Palestinians. But Mr. Trump accused her of sowing chaos.
She hates Israel. At the same time, in her own way, she hates the Arab population because the whole place is going to get blown up. Arabs, Jewish people, Israel will be gone.
That's absolutely not true. I have my entire career and life supported Israel and the Israeli people. He knows that. He's trying to, again, divide and distract.
There was rigorous questioning by the moderators of the former president's position on Russia. They asked Mr. Trump whether he wanted Ukraine to win the war, to which he would say only he wanted the war to stop. Afterwards, in the media spin room, a clamour by reporters as VIP backers of both candidates claimed a win. This was the first and probably the only Trump-Harris election matchup in this format. The number of people still to be persuaded is vanishingly small, and it is their verdict on last night's debate that will be decisive.
Tom Bateman reporting. Well, on NewsHour, we spoke yesterday to Rohan Vijayan, voting in Pennsylvania, which is a potential swing state. He was hoping the debate would help him to make up his mind which way to vote. So when I spoke to him today, I began with something he told us he was looking for, Kamala Harris explaining who she is.
I wasn't too impressed by what I saw, but to answer your question, yes. I mean, it did elucidate a little bit about who she was.
Did she do a good job of holding former President Trump to account? Because that's one of the things you told us that you were keen for her to see do.
Yeah. I mean, I think what she actually did effectively is sort of drop a little bit of bait for him to sort of snap on. So she kind of attacked him on, for instance, his rally crowd sizes that clearly crawled under his skin. And it kind of exposed his temperament, which we all know. I think she did a good job in rattling him. So it was a pretty good strategic move on her part. But there are other reasons why perhaps I wasn't too enthused by her performance yesterday.
You talked about two issues in particular you were hoping would be addressed in the debate. One was the state of the economy, and the other one was migration, and particularly the concerns over the number of people crossing the southern border. What did you make of the candidates' answers to those questions?
Yeah, so again, on Trump's side, predictable. I think I understand his policies from his previous presidency. For the first time, I got to hear Kamala's positions, and to be honest, they sound interesting, you know, these credits for first-time home buyers and for childcare, but, you know, it begs the question, where's that money coming from? I have a lot of doubts about her economic policy that I don't have with Trump. But with regards to immigration, it's almost exactly what I mentioned in my interview yesterday. It's Trump has the right idea about trying to stop illegal immigration. The issue is that he kicks up a lot of, quite frankly, racist sentiment. His comments about, you know, immigrants eating dogs that were clearly debunked. He really roused up his base against, you know, whether or not he's trying to do that intentionally, he's rallying them up against immigration as a concept. And on the flip side, Kamala, I think, answers that better, but she also was the border czar and did absolutely nothing. So I don't trust her either.
You said to us you would prefer different candidates, but did this debate in any way help you towards making up your mind?
To be honest, no. I think that hasn't really changed a whole lot. Again, Trump reaffirmed who he was. And then, you know, Kamala did too great of a job, you know, in coming across as a personable sort of commanding leader that I was hoping that she would. But I think for me, the reason why I'll maintain my position is that Trump reaffirmed his character. And so it really didn't do a whole lot to change my opinion either way.
That's Rohan Vijayan, still undecided despite last night's debate. There haven't been as many presidential TV debates as you might imagine, even fewer that historians think actually affected the outcome of the presidential election that followed. In 1960, John F. Kennedy is said to have triumphed with the TV audience because of his clean-cut appearance, whilst Richard Nixon, his rival, looked as if he hadn't shaved properly. Those who only heard the debate on the radio preferred Richard Nixon. Shannon Felton-Spence is Director of Global Communications and Strategy at Harvard's Belfer Center. I asked her whether Kamala Harris had turned the fortunes around for the Democrats with her performance in the debate.
The Harris campaign is still running as an underdog, as they should. This is Trump's to lose, mainly because so much of the country knows him. Also, because of the way that the Electoral College works in America, it just really favors Republican candidates. But also because the reality is, on the ground, Americans time after time after time are telling pollsters and are telling journalists that, and are telling the candidates that the economy is feeling worse to them now than it was 4 years ago when Donald Trump was president. And it's this age-old sort of campaign slogan, it's the economy, stupid. The economy drives voters like nothing else. And Kamala Harris has a very, very hard time with this because she is the current vice president in which the administration has overseen the economy for 4 years. And so Donald Trump's most successful attack line last night and continually on the campaign trail is, if you could change the economy, why haven't you done it yet? You've been in the White House for 4 years. And that reality is going to be very hard for her to shift.
Is it in either candidate's interest to have another head-to-head TV debate?
Absolutely not. It might be in the favor of the American public, who could probably, you know, use a little bit more in-depth policy exploration and policy explanation from these two candidates, which we definitely need from Kamala Harris. But I think that she risks undoing all the good that she did last night if she goes back on stage with him. And I think he risks her doing as well as she did last night, now that she has seen him and met him and done so well in this debate. So I don't think it's in anyone's favor. I think that they should just call it. They had a debate. Let's move on to the vice presidential debate between J.D. Vance and Governor Walz.
And will that matter?
I think so. I mean, it's definitely going to be interesting. They're two very different candidates from the top of the ticket, Harris and Trump. And J.D. Vance is very smart. He's very quick on his feet. He's quite eloquent speaker. And also Governor Walz is a plain speaker, very accessible in the way that he presents ideas. And so I actually think we could learn a lot on what each of these campaigns plans to do in their governing through the vice presidential candidates, who both have their own unique style that has been resonating with voters.
But Donald Trump isn't going to change himself. Might he change his vice presidential running mate this late in the campaign?
I think there's not an insignificant chance that Donald Trump fires J.D. Vance at some point. I think it would happen. It would have to happen soon, probably within the next 2 weeks if it were going to happen. But listen, his inclination when things are going wrong is to always fire somebody. That's what he's known for. He's really proud of that, that he has no problem sort of cutting people loose when it's not working. I think he hasn't been all that thrilled with J.D. Vance from the beginning, but also they're sort of running out of lockstep on some important messaging points and some important policies. And so I think I don't think that there's an insignificant chance that that might happen. He might scapegoat J.D. Vance and throw him off the ticket, which in turn would really shake up the Republicans and perhaps give them more momentum to run. You could see him replacing J.D. Vance with somebody like Marco Rubio. This is all speculation. I haven't heard it, but I just think he could throw a game changer.
That's Shannon Felton Spence, Director of Global Communications and Strategy at Harvard's Belfer Center, speaking to us from Boston, Massachusetts, with an engaging theory about what might come next. Do stay with us on NewsHour to hear Tim Franks out and about in Georgia, a state which Donald Trump won in 2016, but the loss of which in 2020 helped to ensure his national defeat. Tim's been taking a road trip around the state and assessing the mood among voters there just 8 weeks before America decides who will be its next president. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. And coming up, the interview that sent shockwaves around the world turned into a TV drama.
Emily Maitlis, BBC.
I've been warned about you. I have a bit of a reputation.
Well, for you, I'll try and behave.
I'm sure you will.
When the Prince met the presenter. That's to come in about 5 minutes' time here on NewsHour. Our other main headline, President Zelensky has called for strong decisions from Ukraine's allies as the US Secretary of State and his British counterpart visit Kyiv. President Biden has hinted the US position on the use of long-range missiles could change. And hundreds of Brazilian towns and cities are enduring poor air quality amid some of the worst forest fires in the country's history. All that is here on BBC NewsHour. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Now, for months, we've reported on the programme how the Houthi, the rebel movement in Yemen, has been attacking ships in the Gulf of Aden and in the Red Sea. It says it's in protest at Israel's action in Gaza, but the attacks have also disrupted one of the world's most important commercial shipping lanes. The present US administration backs the government in Sana'a and helped broker a deal between it and the rebel Houthis. But yesterday's joint US-UK airstrikes in the southwest of Yemen underlines how relations have deteriorated as a result of conflict not in that country, but in Gaza. Right now, the Sea Union, a merchant ship which was carrying nearly a million barrels of crude oil, is anchored but stranded after a Houthi attack a fortnight ago. The group says it's agreed to allow the ship to be towed back to port, but the European Union's naval mission, which would have escorted any tugs, says private companies hired to do the work have called it off because the situation is unsafe there. Tim Lenderking is President Biden's envoy to Yemen. When he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him first about the Sea Union.
The situation with the stricken oil tanker in the middle of the Red Sea sort of epitomizes what's going wrong here with this picture, right? I mean, we wouldn't be in this situation if the Houthis weren't sort of attacking Red Sea shipping in a reckless and indiscriminate manner. They've already sunk one ship. They've already caused a bit of an oil spill in the Red Sea. And it's ironic because a year ago, we, including the Houthis, worked together to avert an oil spill on the Safar tanker. It was a big international effort. But here we are with a tanker on fire, at least 8 or 10 fires on board the vessel. It's burning with a million barrels of oil below the hull. And this is not a situation that can last much longer. So there's a very urgent need for a salvage operation. But again, utterly preventable. And we need full cooperation from Houthis.
Now, your administration took them off the terror list, the Trump administration had put them on there. Presumably that opened up the possibility of talking directly to them. How much dialogue is taking place at the moment?
Well, we've been fortunate, I think, to have dialogue with Yemeni parties across the board, and there's no restriction from the administration on those contacts. In fact, the administration said, talk to the people to get this done. And the getting this done is working toward a political process in Yemen and working to mitigate the urgent humanitarian crisis, which is still a problem. It may pale in comparison to Gaza right now, and which is commanding a lot of attention for obvious reasons, but there is still an urgent need to move humanitarian supplies into Yemen.
But in the end, if it wasn't for Gaza, the Houthis say they wouldn't be attacking shipping in the Red Sea and beyond. Presumably, your interest is the same as theirs in the sense you want this fighting to end in Gaza.
We do very much need an end to the Gaza conflict. We need a ceasefire. We need a return of hostages, et cetera. That we hope and are working toward using it to defuse tensions on all the urgent files in the Middle East. And I have no doubt that it will help calm the situation in the Red Sea down, which is an urgent priority.
It is now nearly a year. Do you honestly think it's any closer?
I don't work directly on that. I work very closely with colleagues who are very much involved in that, and I know everybody's making their utmost effort. I've argued to the Yemeni parties and to the Omanis and the Saudis, whose support for an end to the conflict is vital. We can't wait for Gaza to help resolve the problems in Yemen. And if we do that, we're doing the Yemeni people a disservice. And that's where I think the Houthis' priorities are misplaced. We can understand the emotional reasons for wanting to support the Palestinians and doing everything they can, but in fact, the Houthi attacks on the Red Sea are not helping Palestinians, and they're complicating the situation for the Yemeni people.
That's President Biden's envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking. Now, he may be a junior figure in Britain's royal family, barely known anywhere else in the world, but the interview Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, gave to a late-night BBC television programme about his friendship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein has spawned a TV drama. In fact, the second in a matter of months. Emily Maitlis is executive producer on A Very British Scandal, and she was the presenter who brought him into such disrepute. The BBC's Noor Nanji brings us this report about the interview.
Get me and him in a room together, and then I can do my thing.
It's the interview that sent shockwaves around the world. Now a TV drama, starring Michael Sheen as Prince Andrew and Ruth Wilson as the journalist Emily Maitlis.
It was absolutely wonderful playing Emily. I got to be blonde, which I loved, and blondes do have more fun. I went to the News Night offices, and I loved getting involved or seeing behind the scenes of how that world works.
Emily, for you, was it uncomfortable watching someone pretending to be you?
It was extraordinary. She put a sort of comedy into the movement, which I wouldn't recognise in myself. There is a certain amount of chaos, I think, to my off-screen life that Ruth had just watched and seamlessly injected. And the voice was incredible.
Emily Maitlis, BBC.
I've been warned about you. You have a bit of a reputation.
Well, for you, I'll try and behave.
I'm sure you will.
What was it like sitting opposite Michael Sheen as Prince Andrew?
Oh, it was amazing. Obviously, the main interview is the kind of centrepiece of the whole three-hour drama. So it was a 20-minute scene, and we played it like a piece of theatre. Why on earth did he take the interview and do it? That's the big question. It's amazing that it happened.
The 2019 interview saw Prince Andrew talk to Emily Maitlis about his friendship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
I have a peculiar medical condition, which is that I don't sweat.
In it, Andrew denied having sex with the then 17-year-old Virginia Giuffre. He subsequently paid her an out-of-court settlement, but has always rejected claims of wrongdoing.
In a statement, Prince Andrew said, I have asked Her Majesty if I may step...
Days after the interview, he announced he was stepping back from royal duties.
I think there is unfinished business. In some respects, everything changed for Prince Andrew. He lost his royal duties, he lost the ability to wear uniform, he lost the respect of the nation. And on the other side, we don't know if Epstein's victims gained anything from that. We haven't had closure, there's been no trial. It isn't some nice, neat ending with, you know, a comedy villain or a sort of swashbuckling hero. It doesn't end neatly.
Your interview had a massive impact. Do you have any insights on how the palace felt about it?
No, I mean, we can only sort of piece together from what's happened since the response of the senior royals and those around them. A month after I did the interview, I was pulled aside by somebody very close to then Prince Charles. And it was this curious form of words. He just said HRH was not unhappy with the interview. And I sort of spent years trying to puzzle out what that meant.
Buckingham Palace would not comment on her remarks. The Amazon Prime series comes just months after a rival Netflix dramatisation of the interview called Scoop. In Scoop, the portrayal of Emily Maitlis was quite different. She threw tantrums in the office and was seen walking around the newsroom with her dog, Moody.
Three women in a whippet. Wouldn't have seen that in a BBC studio when I started.
But as ever, fact and fiction can differ.
I don't think the dog has ever been to the studio. No, I'm really sorry to disappoint. In my perfect world, obviously, you know, dogs would be everywhere. But Moody has never been in the Newsnight studio.
You do believe me, don't you?
That was Emily Maitlis talking to our entertainment correspondent, Noor Nanji. This is NewsHour.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Healthcare workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo, on the front line of the Mpox outbreak in the east of the country, have told the BBC they're desperate. Our team was given rare access to an Mpox treatment centre in South Kivu, the worst affected region in the world, where infections are rising, yet medical staff say they have no information about when they'll get vaccines and are running out of supplies. Shimi Jolo Osho reports from South Kivu.
The cries of babies are resounding here. As the number of infections rise, the age of the patients gets younger. Murhula Balume is the youngest Mpox case at Luero's community hospital, at only 4 weeks old. It's an agonising ordeal for first-time mom, 18-year-old Faraja Rukara.
It's sad to see my firstborn suffering from this strange disease. I have a lot of pain in my heart. It's a very bad and dangerous disease.
Mpox has caused many to lose their appetite. They have become malnourished. Yvette Kabuya was relieved after her 10-month-old daughter, Amenipa, recovered from the disease, only to get ill herself. As babies pass on Mpox to their parents, there's fear of a new wave of infections. Just over 3 weeks ago, this hospital was used to treat all sorts of diseases and conditions. They used to get around 80 patients a month, but the outbreak got so bad here, they had to convert it into an Mpox-only treatment centre. Now they've had nearly 200 patients in 3 weeks. Healthcare workers here say if the government doesn't step in quickly, things will only get worse. Remaining motivated is difficult for nurses like Emmanuel Fakiri, who's worked here for 4 years. Every day, he fears catching and passing Mpox on to his own children, who are only 7, 5, and 1 year old.
We've learned from social media that the vaccine is already available. So we are asking the government to help us by first giving us the vaccines.
This region of the DR Congo has experienced a battle of control over its mineral-rich land for nearly 30 years, while South Kivu's governor, Jean-Jacques Purusi Sadiki, says the government is doing its best to get medics what they need. He told us the conflict was proving costly and making things harder.
We are accommodating thousands of IDPs. The country is losing a lot of money in trying to address this war. The medicine will come in less than 2 weeks. I'm going to Luero myself. I'm confident that we will succeed.
That certainty is not yet mirrored by staff at this Mpox treatment centre, whose dedication ensured there have been no deaths here. Yet, they promised to keep showing up, despite the bleakness of what lies ahead.
At Simi Jola Osho, reporting from South Kivu in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC with me, Sean Lay. Now, we're returning to the story this edition of NewsHour began with, the US presidential election. Polling day, Tuesday the 5th of November, is a little less than 8 weeks away, but early voting begins in some states this Tuesday. NewsHour presenter Tim Franks and his production team are in Atlanta, the state capital of Georgia. It has been and will be again in this election a critical state in helping to determine who will succeed the president in the White House when Mr. Biden's term ends in January. Now, Georgia, historically regarded as part of the Deep South of the United States, is though a state which has changed a great deal since the civil rights legislation passed in the 1960s. As Tim has been finding, with the outcome in Georgia looking so finely balanced, both Democrats and Republicans are organising the turnout.
This may be Georgia, this may be a special state, a really important state come the election, but there are two things about election campaigns that never really change, wherever you are. One of them, well, it's a bit imprecise, a bit murky, and we'll come on to that. But the first thing, the absolutely key thing you've got to do is get your base out. And that is why I am pounding the streets this gorgeous autumn day with Mila. Tell me who you are, tell me where we are, and tell me what you're doing.
My name's Mila Hersey. I am a canvasser with the Kamala Harris campaign, and we are in Fulton County in Georgia, in the Atlanta area, to knock on some doors and get people out here to vote. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm looking for Mary.
It is her.
Oh, thank you, Mary. I'm Mila. I'm volunteering with the Kamala Harris campaign.
I'm Mary Elizabeth.
You're Mary Elizabeth. Okay, wonderful. And you'll be supporting Kamala in the upcoming election?
Yes.
Oh, I'd love to hear it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So thank you so much for your support. You have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Mila, a couple of successes for you, although I guess lots of people not in or not answering. Just one thing, the opinion polls do say, unsurprisingly, that the economy is top of people's agenda. You know, prices have gone up. Life is tough. It is tough to make ends meet. In a sense, it's difficult for your candidate, isn't it? Because, I mean, she's obviously been part of the administration the last few years, but she's also promising to make a change, make a difference.
I mean, I myself was laid off in this past year. And as a person who myself looks at the economy and I'm like, is it something that works for me? I have to believe that Kamala Harris is the best candidate. And that's why I'm out here.
And if people say to you, well, what is it that she can do that will be different, that will make an impact? What is it that you say?
I think she's been looking out for working class people for a long time. I think about her history as an attorney general in California and protecting people from for-profit colleges. I think about the two stimulus checks that the Biden and Harris administration gave people during the lockdown. And even the student loan abatement just, I think, was a relief to a lot of people. So that's where I'm at.
Michael. Hey, this is Paula Thomas. I live in Augusta, Georgia, and I'm a volunteer with President Trump's campaign in the Georgia Republican Party.
From some of the more rundown streets of Atlanta, we've driven 3 hours east to the land of clipped lawns and huge flags. We're in the suburbs of Augusta, and in this windowless office, there are 20 or so volunteers crammed around trestle tables. They call themselves members of Trump Force 47. They're here to do phone banking, ringing people up who are on their list as Republican-leaning. Can we count on your vote? But just before they all get going, they've got someone to give them a hype speech, as it's been described to me. It's the local Republican district attorney, Bobby Christine.
Tonight is the inflection point at which you can reach your neighbors and implore your neighbors to participate in saving this nation from what well might be a Marxist ending.
Those are some pretty ominous words from the DA, Bobby Christine. He's gone off with his Trump yard signs now, and the volunteers are back hard at work. I'm just going to try and prise a couple of them away from their cell phones and their headphones and their scripts and find out a bit more about why they have decided to give up their evenings.
I'm Destin, and I live in Columbia County, Georgia, and I voted for Trump in 2020. I realize how important this election is. The past 4 years have been very difficult.
How have they been difficult for you?
I'm not able to go to the grocery store and really get everything that I need because I do work, like, sort of in the gig economy.
But what makes you think that Donald Trump will make things better?
Well, I've seen what he's been able to do in the past, and especially the big thing is energy independence here in the States. So we are able to produce a surplus of energy and oil. And the other administration, Biden and Kamala, they have wanted to outsource everything to foreign nations.
Okay, we've done the first part of the how to run an election campaign, at least in terms of the ground game, how to get your vote out. The second part in what could be a close election, well, these are the darker, the subtler arts. How do you persuade the unsure, the unmotivated, the fed up, either to come over to your side or at least not turn out for the other side? I'm going to try and find some of that crowd here this Saturday in this university town of Athens. We're at the campus of the University of Georgia, people turning up to eat and drink and have fun in their tens of thousands before going into Samford Stadium to see the Georgia Bulldogs.
It's obnoxious. There's a lot of malady going on in this country right now that's unacceptable. I wish we had two different candidates. That would be better. But we don't, so we have to go with what we have.
I think there's extremists on both ways where really everybody's pretty moderate. Everybody just kind of wants to go about their day, pay for groceries, pay for gas, pay my mortgage, insurance, want decent health care and education. I think everybody wants the same things. How they go about it is differently.
I am very much of two minds. There are things I like about the Republican Party. There are things I like about the Democratic Party. I've been a Republican my entire life. I am very distraught at the idea that females no longer have bodily autonomy. And so that's weighing heavily on me. I have three girls, and they should be allowed to control what their bodies do. I'm a swing voter. I do not know what button I'm going to push.
What do you think is going to tip it in the end?
So both sides have very damaging issues, and I just would really like to have the old days of we politicize either left or right but come to the middle. We're not coming to the middle anymore, and the most of America is in the middle. So I'm an example of that. I'm fiscally and financially Republican, but when it comes to female autonomy, I am Democrat.
It is striking that in what could be a tight election, and lots of people are saying it's going to be, that it won't need that many swing voters in a place like Georgia to make a difference. And the number of people we spoke to who, even if they were leaning one way or the other, said that they were just turned off by what they saw as the extremity of the debate. It is unlikely, though, that the loudness or the tone will change over the next couple of months.
Well, it's not just how people vote in Georgia. It could also matter because of the way in which the election is conducted there. In 2020, Donald Trump lost the state by fewer than 12,000 votes. Just before the January the 6th riot in Washington, a matter of a couple of weeks before he was leaving office, the defeated president tried to get Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who's the most senior election official there, to overturn the result. In the last few months, supporters of Mr. Trump have become the majority on the five-person Georgia election board, which supervises the poll. Right now, there's the mother of all rows going on about how far they can change election rules, especially this close to polling day. Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State still, is himself a Republican, but he slammed the proposed changes as a recipe for chaos. Well, Tim asked Janelle King, the newest recruit to the state election board, how she responds to that criticism.
He should know more than anyone else what chaos looks like in an election, because that's what happened when he was running it. That being said...
Well, except it didn't happen. No, it happened because Donald Trump complained about it.
No, that's why it's important for us to do these interviews, because we have access to the proof. And there was chaos. Number one, there were 3,000 double-counted votes in Fulton County.
That was audited. It was checked three times over. And it was found that there was no difference was made to the final tally.
Let me continue. So we also found that there are 17,000 missing ballot images that within that same county.
Again, sorry to interrupt, but I mean, if you're going to say these things, I mean, these things happen, but then there was a paper trail, there was a recount, there was an audit, and again, it was shown that there was no difference to the outcome of the election.
Well, if you allow me to continue. Sure. As an elections board member, I have nothing to do with the outcome. I have everything to do with the process. And when you tell me that there were ballots that were double counted, or ballot images that are missing, then that means that there is a break in the process. We need to figure out what happened so it doesn't happen again.
What did you make of Donald Trump in Atlanta last month describing you and the two new Republican members of the five-person election board as pit bulls fighting for victory?
Yeah. Well, first, to be clear, the independence is in the board. So the state election board is an independent entity. We obviously are partisan in the sense that we... Four of us were appointed by Republicans and the fifth person by the Democrat Party.
I mean, one of your colleagues...
I wasn't there.
I know you weren't there, but one of your colleagues was, Janice Johnston.
I didn't know she was going to be there.
Okay, but what did you make of the fact that she...
I think it's fine.
She's appointed by the Republican Party. You think it was appropriate that she stood up and basked and did a 360 and waved to the crowd when the president said she was a pit bull fighting for victory?
I am not going to chastise a grown woman for her behavior. behavior, no more than I would chastise the Democrat that's on our board. I don't know why this grown man decided to support us. Maybe it could possibly be because we're doing the right thing.
Do you have any concern at all that given just how controversial the changes at a very late stage in the election process, and given what we saw in 2020, this could be potentially even greater dysfunction?
I think it's dysfunctional that not just you, but several people have said to me, well, the Republican governor, the Republican AG, and as if because they're Republican that we share the same political views and I'm supposed to listen to them simply because of that. The fact of the matter is I've asked our attorney general to provide me with the statutes, the laws, the codes, anything that you can present to us that tells us that what we're doing is wrong. I have asked the Secretary of State's office for things. He doesn't care about changing anything. He doesn't care about us not doing this. What he cares about is speaking to the media, because that's where all of this is happening. When you talk to people on the ground level, no one is as up in arms or has high anxiety as much as the media does.
That is Janelle King, a member of the Georgia Election Board, who was talking to Tim Franks there in Georgia, where he's been reporting on the forthcoming election. Now, let me bring you some other news that has broken in the last hour. The UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, has said that six of its staffers have been killed in two airstrikes in Gaza. This is NewsHour with Sean Lay, live from the BBC in London. Now, Mexico is to begin electing its judges after the country's Senate voted to support a move by President López Obrador, which he says will help eradicate corruption. There have been big protests by judges and government opponents who say it will politicise the judiciary, reduce the quality, but won't do anything to make judges less vulnerable to bribery. Critics say that the approval, just 3 weeks before the president leaves office, actually will not tackle the main cause of corruption, which is greater among state prosecutors than it is among judges. I've been speaking to Eduardo Porter, columnist and editorial writer at The Washington Post. He's based in Mexico City, the capital. He's not in favour of the reform, and I asked him what will change.
I mean, the most important change is that the entire judiciary is going to be let go, fired, asked to resign or retire, and replaced in some massive election process over the course of the next 2 years. So this is about 7,000 judges that will leave their post and be replaced in elections between now and 2027.
Doesn't being elected mean a form of accountability directly to the public, which will act, as the president seems to believe, to reduce the risk of corruption?
I think that at first blush you might say that, except that the judiciary is really not meant in liberal democracies around the world to respond to the public. The function of the judiciary is to interpret the law, interpret the Constitution, protects the rights of minorities. So if, say, a majority that might win an election wants to rule against a minority, such a minority still have rights, and these rights are meant to be protected by the judiciary. So the notion that this is actually bolstering democracy is not quite right, because it is, in fact, reducing one of the pillars of liberal democracy, which is the protection of minorities.
A contributor I spoke to when the lower house of the Congress voted to support this law said that the bigger problem wasn't the judges, it was actually the prosecutors. Is the government offering to do anything about the level of corruption among federal prosecutors?
Well, not yet. And I would argue, as you pointed out, I am not favorable of this report, this reform. I would argue that the actual motivation of the current reform of the judiciary is not, in fact, to reduce corruption, but to actually align it with the interests of the executive, and hence, like, reduce the checks on the executive's, you know, wish list, not, in fact, to reduce corruption. So, yes, I would agree with the statement that reducing that reforms to the prosecutorial side of the justice system are more important. But so far, nothing has happened on that front.
Do you see any likelihood of this reform, if it is a reform, being changed before it is implemented?
Gosh, that's a very tough question. I actually don't think so. I mean, until yesterday, there was this sense that there might be the Senate might stop this reform from happening because the ruling party, Morena, did not have the sufficient majority of its on its own to change the constitution, but they managed to somehow acquire some senators from opposing parties in order to get the reform passed. And so now it's passed the House, the Senate. It's in fact passed now the legislature of the state of Oaxaca. It needs another, 15 or so states, and the ruling party has way more than that. So it is very likely to become the law of the land.
That is Eduardo Porter discussing judicial reform from Mexico City. He writes for The Washington Post. Kamala Harris played at her post-debate rally the Taylor Swift tune The Man. The singer, whose fans call themselves Swifties, broke her silence to endorse Miss Harris last night. Analysts say the young women who comprise much of her loyal band of followers are likely to be a key demographic in the presidential election. Well, I've been speaking to Jenna Pivovarczyk, a member of the Swifties for Trump movement. In fact, she went viral just a few months ago when she and her homemade Swifties for Trump t-shirt managed to get a photo selfie with the former president himself. So was she disappointed by Taylor Swift's announcement?
It wasn't a surprise to any Swifties. We know that Taylor leans left and the movement is so strong. And besides, this movement wasn't about Taylor. It was about her fans. It's about letting, other young women know that it's okay to love Taylor Swift and not vote the way that she does. You know, the reasons she'll be supporting Kamala Harris are social issues. And my generation, I personally, we don't have the luxury of prioritizing social issues this election season. We're worried about starting families, getting jobs, and owning homes.
Taylor Swift, in the statement she put out after the debate, said she probably wouldn't have revealed her voting intentions, at least not at this stage, had it not been for the way the photograph of you with Donald Trump was presented, not by you, I hasten to add, but by some people online, and it was on his website, sort of implying that she had endorsed him for president. And if it hadn't been for that, she might not have publicly endorsed Kamala Harris. Do you think it was a bit of an unwise move by the campaign?
So I would say that I was disappointed to see that the Trump campaign had posted pictures of AI women in Swifties for Trump shirts because it diluted the realness of the movement. We've had thousands of followers worldwide. We're very real. We've had people come out and support. It's a very real movement. And I think they kind of did the movement a disservice.
And the apparent endorsement by Taylor Swift, the suggestion that she was endorsing Donald Trump?
Trump's post wasn't claiming that she endorsed Trump. He said that she accepts, I believe, I interpreted it as,
yes,
Trump accepts the Swifties for Trump movement.
Right.
Not that he accepts an endorsement, because nothing in there said Taylor Swift endorsing Donald Trump or anything like that.
And do you feel that her values are consonant with being a conservative? In other words, do her values make you feel comfortable in your conservatism?
I would say yes. And I know that a lot of people would disagree with me on this, but she has lived the American dream, and which is similar to Trump. They have built up this empire. They are a champion of American capitalism. Taylor has built this brand for herself. She's a strong female, and I think conservatives should be championing her as that. They shouldn't look at her music or who she supports. They should be saying, now this is a young woman who built herself up. That's what I look at. I also look at, she has this quote that I live by, and it's, I want to wear pink and tell you how I feel about politics. And although she might, swing left and mean that more in a liberal way, I still take that into account every single time I'm prepared to give a speech or prepared to enter an event. Right? Like, I can still treasure my femininity and be true to who I am and also have a say in politics.
That's Jenna Pivovarczyk, a member of the Swifties for Trump movement, still standing by her woman and her man.
I'm Sumiso Maskander from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.